It's recording. We can edit this a little bit. I'm gonna send it off to Troy when we're done.
Okay.
And then Troy is gonna put it up. So, hi everyone. Welcome to Too Young for This Trek again. This time it's not Troy and me, Lokathor. It's actually me, Lokathor, and my brother William.
William.
William doesn't go by an online username because he's too cool. Let's see. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah. So Troy, had to go get our lawyer for this episode. He'll be back soon, but in the meantime, we'll be talking to you.
I have an online username, and
Yeah.
there's even one person who does call me by it because she calls like everybody by their online
Why
username. So
not?
it feels very odd when it happens, but
You just gotta get called by your username enough, and it'll be fine. Or you gotta be like Eric. Eric's online username is just Eric.
well, I don't know. Just most of the streamers and like people on podcasts I know, regardless of anything, they'll just call me William. So,
That's fine. That's fine. All right. Ad Astria per Aspera, season two of Strange New Worlds, episode two. Let's where Strange New Worlds. I want to get the credits on this episode. I like this episode a lot. I think we should take a moment to double check who the writer and stuff is. Writer's Gene Roddenberry? I don't think so. Memory Alpha Ad Astria per Aspera. There we go. Written by Dana Horgan, directed by Valerie Weiss. I believe that's Weiss. I don't think that's a Germanic vice. You want to say anything? You want to just cover the plot beats?
Sure.
We start needing here. I'll hit play on this so that it goes. Don't worry, it's all muted. So we start needing to get our lawyer, and our lawyer is an Illyrian. As has been covered before, Illyrians have a bunch of genetic modifications, which makes them unwelcome in the Federation. So Pike goes to the Illyrian planet where it's kind of smoky. It says that like it's inhospitable to life, and he needs a special oxygen tank to go there, but the thing is, like, that doesn't make sense, really, that you'd put a whole, like, you can't have any plant and animal life, yet it has to be constantly shipping in food or something. That
I
part.
think when they say it's inhospitable to life, he's just being really self-centered.
He
He
could,
means
he's a humanist.
humans.
Okay. Actually, just scrubbing through this, it looks like we did skip the step where we see young Una Chin Reilly, and she has her broken leg. Her parents are like not knowing what to do because they can't take her to the hospital. She's having this as a memory where we see her then in court or speaking to Captain, what's her name? Do you know the name of that captain?
No. I don't know a lot of these characters' names.
Captain, the woman that plays,
She's a prosecutor.
yeah, the prosecuting captain, the woman that plays Mrs. McMurray on Letterkenny. That's how obviously you would know her. They want her to take the deal and quietly leave, but she doesn't want to quietly leave Starfleet. Also, it is funny, she asks, how can my counsel be, working for you? How can they possibly be unbiased? Which is a good question. But then Pike goes to speak to the lawyer, does a good gambit where he nearly suffocates himself, which always. I guess you gotta prove how hardcore you are sometimes.
Yeah.
And then he's able to recruit the lawyer. Let's see. Neera Ketul, played by Yetide Bedaki. I think how you say that. Who doesn't like the Federation. It turns out when you are the law and the law is an apartheid state, that you are not welcome in the place that you are part of the place that is being suppressed.
Well, I don't think that this planet is...
No, I don't think that this Illyrian planet is within the Federation, but I think it's like... He's going to a place he's naturally going to be unwelcome.
Right.
Because of the whole legal thing. Like she couldn't go to the Federation and sign up for his thing, for Starfleet and stuff, and she knows that. But he says that the Federation is wrong, and he is trying to... He convinces her by saying that the platform... she can use this as a platform for her other cases.
Yeah, which will... and she says at one point, like, are you trying to bribe me? And he says no, but, like, he could counter with, like... It's inherently not a bribe. It would be you, like, proving, like, through your own actions, this thing, and, like, getting the attention.
Yeah, I thought that was a weird question, because, like, a bribe is...
kind of like a momentary bad writing.
Yeah, and like, a bribe is an improper reward, whereas if she does a thing and then becomes famous for it, that is a proper function of how society works, so that's not a bribe. Yeah. And I do feel like a lawyer would be, like, really particular about a legal term like bribe. Also, when Pike says, but you didn't say no, that's, like, really Troy energy. He really had Troy vibes in that moment. So then Neera goes to speak with Una. And I guess they knew each other? That seems to be the implied backstory here, right?
That they hold hands at the end like they were lovers.
That could be that. But they haven't spoken in like 25 years. And at the end, she says that like her family left the Illyrian part of the colony and left a bunch of people behind. I think the implication is supposed to be that Neera was on the same colony and that she stayed in the Illyrian section, whereas Una left. But, I mean, I guess that's just me guessing. Commander Face. Batel. Captain Batel is the prosecuting captain. And Batel wants her to take the deal because the deal is very good. But this seems like the deal is actually not very good for Una. The deal is good for the process of the law running smoothly and like not having to try the case and stuff. I don't understand what is supposedly in it for taking this deal exactly.
What do you mean what's in it for her? If she doesn't take the deal and she didn't like win because it's a show, then well, she would have gone to a penal colony for 20 years.
Yeah, but I guess that's so because that the penal colony is because they upped the charges because she didn't take the deal.
But like they had to work to get the deal to not have a prison sentence at all. All
right. I guess I see your point.
They had to put in a lot of effort because she was sympathetic to the case. So she was like completing her duties within the mandate and still managing to get no prison sentence.
All right. And because Batel didn't get the deal to show up, then Vice Admiral Vulcan asshole guy, he upped the charges because the deal wasn't...
He didn't really even up the charges. He just, like, followed them to the logical conclusion.
Okay.
Like, they already knew enough to make all the charges he comes up with in the end.
See... One of the charges is...
Part of what's so, like, bad about, like, most law systems, including the one we're seeing, is that at their discretion, they can decide whether or not to, like, pursue something to even start, like, prosecuting it or whatever.
Yeah.
So that means that they can totally turn a blind eye to this stuff whenever they want on their own case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
And while that could be a good outcome, like, where you're saying, like, oh, sometimes you need to have different things. It's, in practice, in real life, just a way to selectively, like, allow people to selectively enforce laws and make laws that are not inherently discriminatory, all these, though these ones are, you can make laws that aren't inherently discriminatory into discriminatory laws, depending on how you prosecute them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so ACAB includes the prosecuting attorney as well, is what you're saying?
Maybe that's what I'm saying.
Maybe that's what you're saying.
What I think that you can just have a better government where people, like, acknowledge that maybe you should put things such as feelings and human emotions into the law rather than trying to pretend like you are some magical person who's above emotions. Like, literally, even Vulcans in this setting, canonically, are pretty emotion-driven, and they kind of just lie to themselves a lot.
Oh, yeah. Vulcans are the most full-of-crap people that have ever been put into sci-fi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, but that's written into the story. That's on purpose.
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't know that it's on purpose. I don't know that a lot of Star Trek writers realize, like, the good Star Trek writers do, but a lot of Star Trek writers and a lot of Star Trek fans don't quite realize that Vulcans are full of crap. They kind of buy the line that Vulcans have no emotions.
No, I mean, that's the whole thing where, like, if a villain says something convincingly, then, like, most audiences will just believe that villain, even though they're the clear, like, and not to say that the Vulcans are the villains all the time or whatever, but, like,
Vulcans,
they're
villains.
They're shown constantly to be, like, super emotionally driven. I haven't seen that much Discovery, but we see times when there are, like, Vulcan terrorists because they're like, logic tells me to kill you.
Well, so it's funny because Discovery is an example of, like, Michael Burnham is supposedly raised on Vulcan logic, and she is the most passionate Starfleet officer that has ever existed, which usually is good, but sometimes it leads to her, like, being the first famous mutineer because she can't give it up when the captain says give it up, which you might call an emotion.
Sure, but I mean, I think it's shown in all the series. Like, you can see...
Right, it's in Discovery, it's in Enterprise.
In the movies,
all of Enterprise.
They talk about, like, all the Vulcans being racist against Spock.
The entire... the entire arc of Spock across the six movies is to look at a logicless universe in Star Trek The Motion Picture and decide that actually that's not worth it. You should reject that, and you should go back to having connection... Yeah, logicless universe. Like, he connects with V'ger, and he has a moment of, like, pure unemotion, like, what is to be a great intelligence with no emotions. And he, after he has that contact, he decides, that's terrible. And he goes back to, like, having the connection around him with the people of, like, Kirk and McCoy and stuff. Which is to say, maybe Palsik should have, Vice Admiral Palsik should have...
Pasalk?
You know, Pasalk. Oh, you're right. Pasalk. That's where those letters are. Vice Admiral Pasalk.
You do stuff like that a lot.
I do. I'm slightly dyslexic for letters. Pasalk should contact a space probe from Earth from the future.
Well, it's not just reading on the page, because Pianta, famously.
Well, once you read it wrong once, it just gets in your brain in the wrong form. Here's the thing. There's two counts of sedition. What the heck does two counts of sedition mean? Like, is it sedition for something? Because they said it multiple times, plus two, like, lying on the application, plus two counts of sedition. I didn't quite understand that. Is that...
I don't know all of the Federation laws they're doing, but I would assume that they can be like, if you lie about this specific subject, then that can just be an act of sedition in itself.
Okay, all right.
Because I mean, like, it's like 80 years later or whatever, but or maybe it's a full 100 years because this show set earlier and DS9 set later, but, like, what's his name? Bashir gets it just as bad as she does. Like, they want to throw him out, and, like, it doesn't shock me that 100 years earlier they're like, and also it's treason.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, well, we'll get to that at the end. They bring the Neera aboard, Counselor Neera, Lawyer Neera. They bring her aboard, set her up in Una's quarters, and La'an says she's going to get in on the investigation. And then we have Pike talk to Batel, and he wants to be on. I actually think that this is a really important scene within the episode. He wants to be on stand. He wants to go up and speak to Una's character and stuff.
And then she pizones him in like 1 second.
She's having a normal conversation, and then she immediately slips into being a prosecutor and asking the question the prosecutor would ask.
So the tables themselves provide light. So
yeah.
She sits forward from the darkness into the light.
Yeah. She leans in, and she turns their nice conversation into the question that he would face on stand. And I guess you're not allowed to not answer a question on stand.
Because of the way the Federation works. Yeah.
Yeah. So she says, like, if he gets up there, it will destroy the case. And what he needs to do is step out of the way. And then he does. We basically don't see him in the whole rest of the episode. Like he's there in the end, and he's like watching with everyone else during the watching portions, but he mostly stays out of the way, and I think that that's really, really good.
I don't watch the show a lot, but I noticed that Nurse Chapel had, I believe, a full zero spoken words.
She might have had zero spoken words.
She
in
did
this
open her mouth a bit in like either happiness or shock at different moments.
Yeah, I feel like Chapel and Una have not spoken that much, so I could have it make sense that Una has stronger connections to other people around the ship, that they would give them the lines if you're running time.
I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. I'm not saying it's like, it was just kind of funny because every scene with Pike on the bridge, she's also there,
yeah,
but she doesn't like say anything the whole show. So it's just kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That is odd. But like, so I can imagine if this were a lot of other Star Treks, the prosecutor would say, like, you can't go up there, that'll ruin the case. And then the captain would just still do it and then just shout down the prosecution or something.
Finger guns and defeat them.
He just used finger guns to defeat them. And it would just be, it would be terrible. And so I'm really glad that good stories are like a demonstration of how you should act around society. There's like a goofiness and gallant element to all stories, basically. And Pike is a good captain because he lets he found the lawyer to do the job, and then he let the expert do her job competently, and he stayed out of the way and didn't interfere.
Yeah, his stupid hero moment was at the start. He's already been a stupid hero.
He's already been a dumb hero, and he can step off the stage now, and it's good.
I know that this is unrelated, and I keep going off on tangents,
but that's
my favorite podcast. One of my favorite courtroom moments came to mind when they are basically like, O'Brien, we hear that you're defending, you're defending Worf's actions.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, I am. And then they're like, would you have taken the shot? And he's like, well, no, I wouldn't have taken that shot. But like...
he's like, I don't think I would have, but you know.
And they're like, he's like, I've been in a couple battles, and then they say whatever the exact number is, and it's like over 300 battles or something.
Yeah.
He's like, there's been a couple dust ups. I've only blown up tons of ships.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I guess he hasn't been in command of a starship for a lot of those battles. He's been on the starships for most of those battles.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but that is.
But like, part of it is just like he has no idea how many fights he's been in. He's
lost track. Yeah, yeah. So we have a second scene in the officers' mess with Ortegas and Mbenga, and they're watching Spock talk to the Pazok, and I like it. It's another comedy moment.
It's like a funny scene.
Yeah, it's another comedy moment, and I think that this combined with
but all your treks have a lot of funny scenes. There can be totally serious episodes sometimes, but they all gotta have a comedy streak.
I'm not sure that there's that many totally serious all the time episodes that are like even the best. So I
some of Deep Space Nine is very bleak,
but they still have a few jokes in there, or like Maybe
there's
like
stuff that's
dark
funny
humor.
For the audience,
right?
But it's like fucked up,
right? It's not characters telling jokes to each other, but the audience has a laugh. And then, so in this case, Mavenga and Ortegas are watching Spock talk, and then he stands up, has, as far as I can tell, no visible outburst, and then he comes over and he apologizes for his outburst, and they say, oh, we won't say anything. And I like that it's Spock, because this, combined with the previous episode, it's sort of capturing the idea that, like, Spock can be a funny character without himself trying to want to tell jokes in a way that would be unfitting for Spock, but there's still Spock involved
in comedy.
Yeah, like,
it's funny when he says, I want the ship to go now. Like, that's just kind of inherently funny.
Yeah, it's really good.
Because he's, like, so blocky.
He's so blocky and stiff, and it's, yeah, I think it's great. And La'an tries to get Una to hand over all the personal logs.
Not Una.
Oh, sorry, Uhura. La'an tries to get Uhura to hand over all the personal logs sent off the ship during a certain period of time, but La'an doesn't have a warrant, and Uhura's like, I can't do that. And
which is funny, because way later on, Spock and Uhura will be taking illegal orders left and right.
Yeah.
They love illegal orders.
They love illegal orders. Well, when the captain is issuing an illegal order, it's fine, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta decide who the illegal orders you're gonna follow. But, like, I mean, I guess...
I'm not saying it would have been good to change her mind on this. I'm just saying that it's funny that these characters who are so prim and proper now are just like, oh, fuck this.
Yeah. Let's see. Just going through the stuff. After the refusal for the thing, we have the first court scene, right? And April goes up on stand. Actually, we have opening arguments. Did you like the opening arguments?
I think the opening arguments would lose a lot of audience members in certain ways. Because isn't that when she... No, that's...
This is when she first mentions that the laws themselves... The laws of the Federation can be unjust. And
Federation it's not that.
Shouldn't be enforcing unjust... Yeah.
Sorry, I was thinking of the next scene where she's talking to the Admiral. April guy. Mm-hmm. I think audience members in that Admiral... We'll talk about it when we get to it. But yeah. This is good. This is good where she's like... Well, the law isn't necessarily a good enough justification to me.
Yeah. Here's the quote. If a law is not just, then I ask, how are we to trust those who created that law to serve justice? So actually, her opening argument doesn't end up relating as closely to her closing position on the case, but at the start...
That's why I think she just gets all the pieces she needs in the middle.
Right.
She didn't actually know.
She didn't know it all.
She wrote her way out of the scene. It's great.
Yeah. If she's at the start, she's putting the Federation itself on trial, combined with, like, the Admiral April testimony, where she says, oh, hey, you know... You kind of don't follow the Prime Directive whenever it suits you to not follow the Prime Directive. I think this makes Admiral April.
Oh, so it is one extended scene, though.
It's basically one extended scene.
Okay, so it is the Admiral April.
We go to the courtroom, we do opening arguments, and then we don't go anywhere else before Admiral April gets on to the stand.
So I guess I'm going to consider it all kind of one combined thing because of that, like, people post-gaming it afterward. Everyone's like, what is she doing? But I think that she makes a, like, entirely compelling argument if, like, hey, have you re-examined how actually this law is, like, really fucked up and against the stuff that you would claim that the Federation is for?
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, they won't examine it because the Federation is the state. And so they can't examine anything too closely.
The Federation is like a mostly good guys version of the United States, where the United States turned out to, you know, just be the real world mostly bad guys version of the United States.
Battelle's opening argument is that the eugenics wars on Earth happened and caused the death of tens of millions of people. Therefore, genetic engineering is playing God, which is really weird for a supposedly majority atheist society to argue for.
But on the other hand, Kirk endangers does that the all
essence.
The time.
Well, Kirk does do that all the time. You're right. You're right. But it endangers the essence of natural evolution, which is like, what the heck is that about? Like, there's so we've and so part of this information also comes from the related Deep Space Nine episode. But like the Federation cures all sorts of birth defects. They have that much genetic augmentation, and they decide that there's like some sort of magical line, like people living on an ash atmosphere planet, that's illegal, but it doesn't, it's completely inconsistent, I feel.
It's pretty inconsistent. Also, like, I think that probably there were changes between the time periods because, again, in story, the two time periods are like nearly 100 years
you're
different.
Right. So perhaps we could take this as one leads to the other, and so that's why more is allowed by Bashir's time.
Yes.
You're right, you're right.
That's why when I was using it as an example, I forget if this was when we were already talking or when we were just watching the episode, but
yeah.
I was using it as an example of, like, they're still willing to totally go hard on Bashir, like, kicking him out of the Federation. I forget if they discussed jail time or not for perjury, but...
I think it was supposed to be jail time for his parents was part of the...
Oh, yeah, and they did end up going to jail, so his parents did go to jail, like they talk about in this episode.
Yeah.
Just not until he was an adult.
Yeah. April is asked if he had known about the gene mods of Unich and Riley, would he have recommended her for Starfleet? I feel like a better Admiral April could have said, I don't know. Like, I think he could have landed on that middle point.
I don't know. I really like how the scene plays out. I like how he, like, is clear, like, not that I think he's on the right side of things, but I think it's a stronger thing to not be wishy-washy about it and to have his character have specific convictions, and he, like, states aloud his reasoning for, like, why. I thought it was very well put together, I guess.
You're right. He's consistently written. I think, it's a bad look for April, but it is good writing for April.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You're right. And then everyone back in the conference room is like, is she going after Admiral April now? And then, yeah, Pike's like, you know, oh no, or whatever. But he doesn't even really speak to the rest of the crew in this moment or anything. Next, we have character witnesses for La'an. La'an, Mbenga, and Spock are character witnesses for Una.
Yeah.
And how'd you like this? I really like this. I thought that
it was a good
interspersed editing.
They didn't do, like, one at a time. They did all three.
Yeah.
Which, like, we've seen that before, but we've also seen the stale version where they just do one witness, two witness, three witness. So we've seen, like, very standard plain stuff in the past, and I think this lines up with the better courtroom scenes from DS9 and TNG. Well, actually, I can't think of a good TNG example where they're shifting around. Maybe just the DS9 stuff.
So I'd say the main courtroom scenes in TNG are
Measure of a Man. Only has like two people who talk.
Yeah. And then also it has the one where the devil shows up because she bought the planet, or she claims she's the devil that bought the planet, and then she's actually a charlatan. Yeah, of course she's a charlatan.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
TNG hates your god. I'm sorry. Whatever religion you are, TNG hates it. TNG doesn't think gods are real, and they're very clear about that.
Well, I get it. I mean, I look around and see charlatans every day.
Yeah. And that's, but those are both their very plain court scene style. I think they've all been pretty plain except this one. I can't think of another one where they do cut up.
Well, I think in, maybe I'm misremembering, but I thought in the same Worf courtroom where what's his name is like, oh, don't say I'd pull the trigger on that. I thought that O'Brien and Cisco's like at different points early on they got.
I think they have
a lot of Cardassian like trial scenes. So maybe I'm totally misremembering, but I thought there was at least one or two where they do that, where they like totally switch between people just like this. But this could be a totally new technique. I don't know.
Well, it's
not new to movies or anything, but new
it's
to
not
Star
new to
Trek.
Movies. I think it's relatively new to Star Trek, and I think they do it really well.
Yeah, they do. I thought the affinity for Gilbert's and Sullivan musicals was that was a bit much. It was a little too twee of a moment when Spock's like, ha ha, got him.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with like Hollywood people loving Gilbert and Sullivan stuff that much. I mean, they do. They definitely do.
I'm not saying that Gilbert and Sullivan is bad. I'm just saying it was a bit much for me when Spock was like, I'm doing a bit on the stand.
Yeah, maybe don't do bits when you're at a court martial.
No bits on tips.
No bits on tips and no bits at court martials.
You're saying she was hiding.
Yeah, like, why would you say that, Spock?
No, I was doing the first part of a bit, please.
Yeah, I don't...
It is my one human trait. I cannot stop myself.
Mbenga says that she is discreet and handles personal matters with care. Of course, that would relate to from season one when he had the daughter in the transporter beam and all that. I don't remember how much you may remember of season one.
I think I've seen one episode.
Oh, I thought you seen the whole thing.
And I don't fully remember what we watched a couple weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, or whatever, when
the
first one came out.
From season two, yeah.
I know, but I'm just saying, I do not remember the full contents of that episode.
That's fine. And La'an, of course, speaks about how she'd been rescued from the Gorn. I think La'an giving the character witness in favor of Una is more powerful because of, and you, I guess you don't remember this part, but she really, really flies off the handle and like tries to fight Una when she first finds out that Una is an Illyrian. And she like really, really hates it. And they kind of reconcile a little bit, but then seeing that La'an's come all the way back around to saying that like she's family and I wouldn't be alive and none of the people I've saved would be alive, I like that.
I wasn't gonna like dispute it during the fact, and I get what they were doing, but in my brain for just a split second I was like, yeah, but if you're not there a different Federation officer is, and they might be a badass too. There's a lot of badasses.
Yeah, I mean, it's Is it a psychohistory view of history or a great person theory of history view of history? I don't know.
Well, listen,
we can go psychohistorical much more often, I bet.
I personally think that it is a like people put it's like more than just a spectrum of those two things. It's like more complicated than either of those two explanations. And it's both of those explanations. Like, it's not that it's, like, specific people, although there are, like, in many instances, you need enough, like, personal history in the world to build up clout. So if specific people were, like, just dead from a heart attack, then there wouldn't be a person to fill that space.
Yeah.
But overall in culture, like, the psychohistory thing makes sense. However, individual decisions have been supremely important in a number of events.
It's true.
Like when you have the power to or to not do the nuclear button. If they had ever done the nuclear thing in the Cold War and ended the world, well, guess what? Psychohistory doesn't matter at all at that point.
Yeah, psychohistory can't predict nuclear attacks, really.
Yeah. So then we
can say that like there definitely is an element in support of specifically saving La'an from Gorns, and then she's a specifically
good officer. Like I agree with that, and I didn't want to undercut it by saying the nuance. I just thought it was a little like there's more to it than that.
For those not familiar, the term psychohistory comes from the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov, wherein a mathematician predicts that given the trillions of humans within the galaxy, you could do a bunch of math models to predict how the galaxy's fate is going to unravel
over hundreds of years. I think it's truly ridiculous.
It's truly ridiculous, but it kind of works as a science fiction conceit to tell a bunch of short stories. So,
well, it works as a conceit, yeah, but I would say even in things like Legend of the Galactic Heroes, you can think of, like, while there are greater trends, there are also such definitive moments where the entire war pivots.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's yeah, not one or the other, definitely. So then we go back to the Enterprise, and La'an brings K'Tool, a hard printout of the Starfleet laws, or a volume out of presumably a large number of volumes. And La'an is concerned. She reveals that she's concerned that she was the cause of the leak as to the information about Una being a Illyrian, and K'Tool says, no, you didn't do it, because it takes months to get a subpoena like this to happen, and they've moved too quickly, so we know that it wasn't anything that would have been in your personal logs.
They've been kind of calling her K'Tool, and you have been calling her Neera at the start, so just to be clear, Neera K'Tool is one person.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry. We're skimming through the memory alpha as a way to keep ourselves in order. And there's also an amazing speech. So La'an also says that she's concerned that she has some sort of genetic augmentation in her, I guess. It's unclear if she knows that she does or if she's concerned that there is an augmentation. But then Neera's basically like, look, they told you to hate yourself because that is part of the system of suppression that exists, and you should, like, not concern yourself with these lies that you've been told, and it's very difficult, but you need to move past that, and that's the only way that you can, like, move towards liberation, is, I guess, the phrase? Like you can't exist as a complete and fulfilled person if you're going to keep pulling their persecution into yourself and then self-persecuting yourself and just hating yourself for having these augmentations that you do, you know?
Sure.
I don't know if you wanted to say it. It was a very good speech. Fun. Hit by a shuttle, parentheses, complimentary. I like it. I like when they take, at the end, she's like, yeah, why do I feel like I've been hit by a shuttle? And if it was like a modern person, they'd be like, why do I feel like I've just been hit by a car? And I like when they take a standard phrase and make it a Star Trek phrase.
So mom knew someone who would say, I feel like I've just been hit by a Mack truck, all the time.
Yeah.
No, she would say a Mack truck.
A Mack truck.
Which is a specific kind of truck.
Right, isn't it?
Then she was hit by a Mack truck in real life.
Oh. Isn't a Mack truck... It's one of those big, like, multi-wheel trailer trucks.
Huge truck. It's very, very big grill on the front.
Very big grill.
Yeah, and she really was hit by a Mack truck.
She really was hit by a Mack truck.
But later,
after she had felt like she'd been hit.
She didn't die from getting hit, but you easily could.
You definitely could.
Yeah.
At even pretty low speeds.
Probably.
Yikes. Okay, so then we get to the final court case, or the final courtroom scene, but it's like half the episode, isn't it?
You skipped over the scene where... So, April talks to the captain in his quarters.
Oh, we didn't mention that. After April gets off the stand, he goes to talk to Pike, and he is unhappy with Pike.
He had wanted to testify as a character witness positively for Una.
Yeah, but he didn't get the chance because the lawyer was a little too rabid.
He got him.
She got him. So yeah, it looks like there's about 20 minutes left in the episode when we begin our final court scene, which goes on for a very, very long time. And this is where we get the...
21 minutes left. Because then 21. We'll be able to look at how much time is left when it's over.
Oh, yeah.
With math, we can subtract.
I wouldn't subtract anything. This is where we get the title of the episode. Ad Astria per Aspera...
Astra.
Ad Astra. See, again, I just... Extra vowels, wherever they want to go. Ad Astra per Aspera. You know where I said Astria is because of Stargate?
I mean...
Astria Porta is the Stargate. That's why I said Astria. Ad Astra per Aspera is to the stars through hardship,
mm-hmm.
Which Una says can also mean that the stars can save you from hardship, that you go through the hardship and then you are sort of out the other side. It's very good. It's very good.
I don't know. The language she uses is much better than what Daniel just said. I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay.
I'm not trying to roast you, but it was very powerful in the episode and did not feel like...
I mean,
conveyed that very well.
That going to space and traveling and exploring is how people can find salvation from the problems that have been plaguing them on any individual planet or in any particular place.
Mm-hmm.
That she was, a year before she was born, her colony became a Federation colony, and it very obviously turned into an apartheid location. Immediately.
She tells the court the backstory that we saw a scene about at the start.
Yeah. So when we hear that things get worse and worse as the divide between the augments, the Illyrians, and the non-augmented standard Federation citizens increases. And then there's a fight at her school where she breaks the leg.
I don't think that Augment and
Illyrian
are really... I mean, the guy got called an Augment.
An Augment is a different thing, yes. An Augment is usually used to describe the Khans group of superhumans, super gene soldiers.
Right, like if you told me La'an was an Augment, I'd be like, yeah, probably.
I mean, she probably is. She probably is. I think that's what she admitted to the lawyer, is that she's an Augment, and no one can tell, or something. I don't...
Yeah.
I don't know how she got through all the stuff, if she really is an Augment, but that was the implication that I took. So the Illyrians, the persecution against them increases over time, until eventually... the Federation literally has to try and split the city in two to prevent the Illyrians.
I don't know if they have to
reduce. You're right. They don't.
Much as the Federation does many bad things, they decide
Much as the Federation does many bad things, the Federation decides to split the colony into two separate locations to reduce the number of incidents of contact between Illyrians and non-Illyrians. Thus attempt to reduce the harassment that way, rather than taking the more productive path of simply not persecuting the Illyrians in the first place. It's like saying, it's like any other apartheid situation. There's two famous apartheid situations in Earth's history and modern times, and neither of them are good. And they're both being enforced by various states, local and foreign. So,
It's usually only works because they're propped up by allies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in this case,
like South Africa and Israel, right?
Yeah, South Africa and Israel are the two that I was referring to.
Yeah.
I'm sure if I knew more,
there's more going on than that. But those are the two most famous ones. I just assumed that's what you meant.
Yeah. So basically, the argument, she says, what was it? Yeah. she lays out all of her history before going to Starfleet. And here is also where it is again implied that she knew Neera Ketul when they were younger, and Neera stayed in the Illyrian portion. That's where I'm getting this from. But the... I don't know, it makes the Federation look really bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that the Federation is being written like... I think they're honestly talking about the problems of the early Federation in this, but then in the other one, I don't... Some of the other shows, I don't even know what they're doing with the Federation. Like, no, the Federation is definitely regressing in Picard, which, like... I mean, I get what they're going for and stuff, but the Federation of the DS9 era, like, I guess they're, like, kind of... I don't know. It just seemed like... The reason that the protagonists were able to keep overcoming the forces that were trying to make it an authoritarian society is because the baseline nature of their culture is different. They have different ideals, so it's harder to sway them to those sorts of things. They're not like, you know, 2023 Americans or whatever.
Right.
They're like from the future, and they grew up in a different culture that's, like, so radically different.
Well...
And they always, like, put the kind of social, like, changes that are happening now as though it would, like, work the same, but I think that's a little... I don't know. And this is me indicting Picard, so...
Yeah.
Totally wrong show.
No, it's... Yeah, it's fine.
But, you know, I just think of these things when we talk about Star Trek.
I think... I don't think that this is a radically different Federation... For most other things. I think if this were anything about except modified genetics, that it would look exactly like the normal Federation. And I think that the problem is specifically that they have these, like, little niches where some sort of racism is allowed to persist. This is this on a safe and allowed type of racism.
Yeah, like
that the Federation
data.
Is allowed to keep doing. Against Data, against Illyrians, against Ferengi.
Borg.
The Ferengi thing comes up over and over, and we never care about the Ferengi at all. Like, it's, you can definitely be as racist as you want against the Ferengi, and no one will bat an eye, and it's not that great, but that's what happens. And so... This episode is shining a light on one of those little spots. Except, I think what makes it make the Federation look pretty bad is that we know that 100 years from now, nothing will have significantly changed.
Right, basically. Well, that's the thing is, like, they talk shit on Ferengis, but then, like, a Ferengi joins the... within the timeline of the shows... Nog joined Starfleet like 10 years after the start of Next Generation starting.
Something like that, yeah.
Something almost exactly like that. And then after that happens, like in all future iterations, we see like relations with the Ferengi have gotten better. And also like the less specifically like hyper-capitalist they get, like the more integrated with other, like, because there's, you know, the massive social changes on Ferenginar
right.
at the end of DS9, the more they can integrate with other stuff, like, the less... Because the Federation is incredibly averse to the Ferengi.
Right.
But that's because it reminds them of their own terrible past, including a recent past where they had, like, space miners who were, like, buying women and stuff.
Right. They're, I mean, yeah.
They see the Ferengi and they're like, oh no, it's us.
That, and so that's the claim here, is that the Illyrians,
oh no, it's us.
Yeah, they remind them of their own checkered history, their own, like, oh, we accidentally tried to make superhumans, and so we will never believe that this technology could be used for reasonable purposes because a few people tried to misuse it. And it's like, I don't know, maybe don't build nuclear reactors, don't build warp reactors if you think that a few things going wrong means you should never use the technology.
You could fling a warp reactor at a city and blow it up.
Yeah, you can do a lot of bad things with every other technology available. Maybe just, I don't know. And I think maybe it's partly a sign of, like, it's part of this particular setting as a whole, based on when the setting was made. If you look at
all of what made in the shadow of World War II.
It was made in the shadow of World War II. And like it when it was every time it was touched upon again, they just sort of copy that forward, which is often happens in Star Trek. But like in the culture novels by Ian M. Banks, there's massive amounts of genetic modding. It's an incredibly transhumanist look at what we could do with technology.
Right. I think of the Federation as like a pretty shallow vision of a utopian future.
Yeah, it's not even a utopia. They call it a utopia. They literally say the word utopia in this episode, but it's not a utopia. We see time and time again that it's not a utopia for large numbers of people. You can look anywhere and find the Federation messing up.
Yeah, the Federation has really good planets, but it also has, like, all of the Outer Rim stuff, basically. I know they don't call it that in this, but...
Right.
You know what I mean. The borders of the Federation all fucking blow.
Yeah, it's not good. Because they get,
like, wrecked all the time by, like, space gas that can do god powers or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that so like, environmental accidents are bad, but, like, it's even the Federation doing bad stuff.
Yeah, well, there's that, too. But I just mean, like, the Federation does bad stuff and has, like, bad laws in some ways. But, like, compared to current society, like, is clearly much better for the vast majority of people.
You're right.
Because, like, current society is fucking terrible.
Yeah.
And, like, Star Trek, pretty good. If I could live in Star Trek society instead of this society, pretty much this year or later of the Star Trek, I don't want to go back into their past. A lot of the earlier stuff did really blow.
No, I mean, even the Earth as presented in Enterprise would be a radical improvement.
Yeah, yeah, if I could live on Earth in Enterprise. But, like, I also don't want to get nuked by the Zindi.
Just stay out of Florida. And so, all right. So, to bring it back around,
remember that really bad CGI shot where they zoom out?
I do.
I couldn't stop thinking about it after you said stay out of Florida.
To bring it back around, Neera hands the physical tome that she had to Batool. With a bookmark in it,
and
the
Catul.
Book Catul,
Neera Catul,
Neera Catul, but then the captain is
Betal.
Betal? Betel?
We should listen to how they say her name.
Betel, B-A-T-E-L. She hands Catul hands Betel the bookmark.
Betel.
Yeah, Betel.
You said Betel.
Well, okay. And
this is what the listeners are here for.
I know they're definitely here.
Me
for
Me being
this.
The worst.
So the book is a prop. Don't you love a courtroom prop?
Yeah, I mean, we can't bang our fists on the table because they didn't give us a very good table for that.
No.
But we can set a prop down.
Yes. So as a courtroom prop, she hands over the book. Betel is called upon to read the conditions for
asylum,
that's the word for asylum. And it turns out, we do some flashbacks as she's reading it, it turns out that asylum applies in this case. In fact, preliminary asylum has implicitly already been granted by Pike, and all that the three judges have to do is confirm the asylum status, which will then get her off the hook.
You know what I like about this episode?
Yeah.
You don't gotta know nothing about Star Trek to watch this episode.
It's very good.
Like, there's even, like, a famous character you can latch onto with Spock. You're like, I've heard of that guy.
Yeah, I've heard of Spock.
I saw him on a poster once.
Yeah, he was in a movie. He was in the movie with the Chris Pine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spock. And so then the court agrees. It's very heartwarming.
Wait. This is another dumb question.
Yeah.
The cage. You know the first officer from the cage? Is she in this show?
That's not Una. That's her.
That's Una?
That's who she's playing.
But she looks a lot younger in the cage. Like, younger than 25 years in the Starfleet would have... I don't know. Maybe I'm misremembering. I remember her looking like...
Yeah.
More the kind of age of, like, I don't know, the younger members of this crew.
Yeah. So this is what she looks like in the 1966.
So that's like episode. Several years later that she's supposed to look like that.
Well, yeah.
I guess.
I mean, look at Spock. Look at Spock compared to what we got in...
Spock looks a number of years older to me in this. Leonard Nimoy looks significantly older than whoever is playing this person.
And but she's an Illyrian. She's going to live longer.
She's going to de-age by the time of she's this because de-age. Of her Illyrian genetics.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's going to get some sort of additional gene mod or something. Or she'll get a disease and her skin will glow until she de-ages.
I just had assumed that it was a different person because...
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Same person. Well, it's same character.
I only get to show him two episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah.
This one and The Cage. In that order.
Yeah. And then everyone will just be like, what? That's the same character? And he's just like, yeah, it's fine. Don't ask where all the cardboard styrofoam went between The Cage or leading into The Cage. Don't where all the cardboard and styrofoam came from, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hmm. So, some people are really... They're really picky about the visual distinction, but I'm not sure that the visual stylings are as important compared to the character's attitudes.
I can be picky about the visuals. It really bothers me that in Discovery, they live in the ultra future where they have like holodecks and stuff. Like, I don't like that. That's weird. Why would you add holodecks into the pet? It's fine when there's even in Enterprise, when we see like a space alien who has a holodeck, that doesn't bother me. But when Federation ships like suddenly have ultra tech from 150 years in the future, I don't like that. That's
right.
Just dumb.
That is silly. And they should
just set it in the future.
It's fine to have a character on a view screen. They still have people on view screens. So just have people be on view screens within the ship too. You're right. That puts it particularly with holodecks. And because there's so many episodes in TNG about them learning how the holodecks can do anything.
This is our first one, and it can only do this forest. But, I mean, it's pretty lit,
right? It can do this forest, and it can do one karate training program. And also, it can outsmart Data if you ask it nicely.
Yeah.
So then we go to the transporter room, and Una comes back to the ship, and they talk about how this is a technicality win.
Mm-hmm.
And so apparently Illyrian apartheid is still out there and continuing for potentially forever. So that's not great. Don't think about it, I guess.
Well, we know from like the Data thing that while Data was allowed in, they specifically made more and more specific racist laws after that, where like because of his entrance, people thought about it more and then like were like, hey, how can we make bots that are slaves? And then, like, you know...
They do that at Picard. They specifically have, like, low-intelligence workers that they are fine having be property. Great! So, the Federation is evil.
Well, but that's...
Not exactly evil, but...
That's...
That's exactly what evil is. Evil is to tell you that something is good and great, and because they do so many good things, they're allowed to also do bad things.
Well, no, but see, what I was going to say is that's what I don't like about that Picard future is it didn't feel right to me. It felt like because of the baseline attitude of the different Federation citizens we see throughout the show, not only in Starfleet, but on planets, not only Earth, but other ones, because we rarely go to Earth.
We rarely go to Earth.
Then, like, it just didn't feel like it made sense that that's the direction things would trend. If it were real life, of course that would happen, because we live in dumb world.
I think part of it is that, you know, after enough wars, the people on Earth get very nervous, and I can see them regressing.
Hmm.
But that's not this episode.
Yeah.
I guess we don't have to worry about that.
I'm just, I can't stop thinking about other, whenever I think about one Star Trek thing, I think about all the other Star Trek
things. It's true, that is how Star Trek works. And I think that's, Star Trek encourages you to be thinking about all the other Star Treks all the time. Like, good Star Trek is asking you to imagine that
Star
Trek. Good
Star Trek is reminding me that this is the same character as in The Cage. That's crazy.
Yeah. This is the best episode of Star Trek we've had in so one person said since 1999, and that would be like, what, 24 years? And then I went and looked up the dates, and I said, no, 1998, because that is season 6 of Deep Space Nine, which has some episodes that I'm sure you love.
Like In the Pale Moonlight?
Yeah.
Six,
yeah, that
619.
One. Well, also the Siege of AR-337 or whichever, whatever
that whatever the number is.
But yeah, whatever. The asteroid one.
Yeah, that one's really good.
That one's really good. And In the Pale Moonlight. Those are really amazing episodes.
Where, I think the one where Nog lives in the holodeck is really good, too.
That's also amazing.
But that's in season 7.
But that's in season 7.
So you got to extend it a year because season 7 was good. Take that.
Take but that, what good is this episode?
Yes.
I feel like this episode beats it a little bit.
I mean, I guess. I like when Nog lives in the holodeck.
You're right. You're right. You're right. All right. I'll reduce it to 24 years.
If I were to tier them, I would say like even style tiering. They're both like A ranks, but they're like I have a very high ideal of what an S rank Star Trek is.
A very high ideal?
Uh-huh.
How many S rank Star Trek episodes
should Conspiracy
you
say? Is an S rank Star Trek episode.
Conspiracy, of course.
For me, In the Pale Moonlight is an S rank episode. Some of the ones in the 10-parter end of Deep Space Nine are full S tier.
Would you say that there's less than 10 or less than 50 S rank episodes?
Well, there's a lot of Star Trek. There's probably...
Or maybe less than 25. Like approximately how many S ranks would you guess?
There's probably less than... Let's imagine there's around 20.
Okay.
But there's a lot of Star Trek.
There is a lot of Star Trek.
And The Cage is an S-rank episode.
So,
like, it's so good. Like, it's incredible that it's the first episode.
It is incredible. If you haven't seen The Cage, watch it.
Most people who have only casually watched it have seen The Menagerie, which is a recut of The Cage. But damn, The Cage is so good.
I think part of what makes The Cage work is the pacing. And so when you recut it, it diminishes it by quite a bit.
Yeah, because, well, the pacing of The Menagerie, in my opinion, is very bad, because they spend tons of time just, like, it's a courtroom episode, but they, like, stare at Spock, stare at Kirk, stare at Pike, they just, like, stare at the three characters, not really saying a lot, and it's like, Spock, why aren't you saying anything? And it's like, Captain, because blah, 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 and it's very boring.
I mean, I think the reason that The Menagerie exists is because some sort of writer's strike or something like that. Like, they were basically just filling time.
I would believe
Or they were out of money and they just needed to fill
they
time.
Needed they needed episode space. Yeah. No, I get it. I'm just saying that nothing. like the episode itself, while the pilot and unaired, most people who are like, Menagerie is good enough. Because like our friends who are watching Star Trek with us, we did skip The Cage and only watch The Menagerie. And I was a treat to ourselves, when we finish TOS, we must watch it.
You have to watch The Cage.
Because, like...
Great episode of Star Trek or greatest episode?
Well, it's not the greatest, but it's it's a top fiver, I bet.
The Cage? Yeah, it's real good.
Like, I just think it's... And it's before they did that thing where...
Do you want to know something?
Women can't be captains in Starfleet.
Do you want to know something nuts?
Written in the 60s.
You know how The Cage exists as a show that was meant to be
like to know.
Pilot episode? Or rather, you know that it was.
Yes.
They had several scripts up to be pilots of the show. Uh-huh. Mudd's Women was one of the potential pilots.
Oh my God.
Imagine the Star Trek version that has Mudd's Women as the pilot.
I hate that episode. It's so it's so sexist and bad. Not that Star Trek TOS is not sexist most of the time, but, it's just a new low for that show.
Star Trek is kind of avoiding a lot of the sexism most of the time in the original series. Yes, it's you have to judge by 60s standards or whatever, but, like all the miniskirts and stuff is supposed to be that that all these women are like sexually attractive and still also in the workplace. They haven't been shoved out of the workplace just by being attractive. So that is supposed to be, within the context of the 60s, a sort of liberatory thing.
Right. But then the episode about how they take a space drug that's killing them, that they're addicted to make them hot, yeah. so that they can sell themselves as wives mm-hmm. to base miners.
Yeah, maybe don't do that.
Just move to Earth. You're Federation citizens.
I feel like they should just move to Earth.
Just move to Earth.
Or maybe that
get
episode...
Get medical treatment.
The, what was it? The episode where like there's the woman that wants to be captain and she could never be captain someday. The episode that was so bad that we had to make a point of having a woman be a captain in Star Trek Enterprise so that we could negate that that episode ever happened?
Yeah, they retconned it out of existence because in part of TOS that was like just very much a normal episode, they're like, women can't be captains.
No, it was the last episode.
Oh, it was the last
episode? I'm pretty sure, I'm 99% sure it was the last episode of the original series that ever came out.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
And then they canned them the next week? Because I know it was, like, I thought it was pretty unceremonious. Like, they didn't know when their last episode was going to be.
Let's see. 79 episodes. Yeah. 29, 26, 24. Turnabout, yeah. Turnabout Intruder. Yeah, last episode. All Our Yesterdays, great, would have been cool. Turnabout Intruder, garbage.
So, wait.
Let me get the memory alpha version of this. Yeah, Turnabout Intruder has the whole body swap and stuff. Oh, 80 out of 80th released? Oh, so The Cage got released after Turnabout Intruder as its own.
Oh.
That's cool.
I wasn't sure if they just slipped it into the order when they would play it on TV later, or if they actually officially aired it with the show ever. I hadn't thought they did, but
yeah. All Our Yesterdays is caves, and that would have been fine.
Star Trek caves are classic.
Who doesn't love a Star Trek cave? Do you have anything that we should say before we wrap up this episode?
This is good.
This is very good.
It made me want to watch more of the show. And it's not that I wasn't enthused, but like, I've heard a lot of bad things about the second and third season of Picard, like overall. And then
they're terrible.
And then I've personally not liked Discovery very much. And like,
Discovery is very bad.
Whenever I talk about not liking Discovery, I think somehow people assume I'm like, some internet shithead who doesn't want there to be diversity in Star Trek. But
that is
like,
a problem.
It's like, no, that's not the problem. It's that I want the future to be like, I want the people of the future to not just be like reuniformed versions of ourselves now. They did not grow up on the hellscape that is our current day Earth. They grew up in the nice future, and they are well-meaning people driving about the galaxy trying to do their best. And some of them get gritty and war-hardened, but that only happens after they've been flying around.
Yeah, I think part of it is that humans in Star Trek are supposed to be just as alien as everything that we call an alien in Star Trek, because
it's supposed to be the best of ourselves.
Yeah.
The most like well-meaning, like family-oriented, like exploring, like mentally curious.
Yeah.
Like it's supposed to be like an ideal of the future, not just another extension of what we're doing now.
Yeah. And so there are the problem with Discovery is that it is the queerest Star Trek that has existed ever. Ever.
As a queer person, it's not one I'm interested in, though.
Well, but see, that's the thing. There are a lot of people that want Star Trek to have that.
And there are a lot of people that don't want Star Trek to
have that. And so a lot of the Discovery detractors are detractors specifically because they hate queer people. And so...
It just sucks because you don't like
Discovery for some other reason, such as because I don't want a season-long arc about the universe exploding. I want small episodes.
And, like, I don't want a Klingon double agent, like, plotline, because while it's possible, like, I guess we can devote like a whole character slot on the main crew to being a double agent Klingon guy. I guess.
I don't think it needs to go on that long. like one episode where there's a secret agent in this episode and they're like not who they are. And then at the end, it turns out that the Klingon ambassador was working with the Romulans. That was an episode and that was fine. And that needs to be one episode, not the entire season.
Yeah, they have like a whole... They and like... the idea that they put him in the specific prison to escape with this specific prisoner, doesn't even though they were sense. Getting shot at by, like, the you know, set your phasers to gore, the disruptors yeah. that explode you.
The ultra gore.
They're getting shot by these, like, ultra death guns, yeah. and it's like, so you psy-opt a guy to have human genetics, and you are willing to just blind fire down a hallway at him? It yeah. seems like a lot of investment to just kill that guy. It would be a lot of
investment to shoot at your own guy and like accidentally just, blow up your entire plans.
All those other people weren't in league with them.
Yeah.
They didn't know.
Didn't make any sense.
Also, I didn't like how their guns are way more powerful, even though it's the past. Why wouldn't the future Klingons use the Ultra Gore weapons?
I don't know. It's safer for ships. They switch to phasers that are still lethal, but aren't going to blow a okay. hole through the wall of okay. a ship.
Cool.
yeah. That's why it works. It's fine.
I guess.
Yeah.
They were missing them a lot on Discovery, too, so they clearly didn't seem to harm the wall.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Do we have anything more that we want to say specifically about this episode or Strange New Worlds? We're not here to rail against New Trek. Don't worry. When Discovery Season 5 comes out, we can complain about Discovery Season 5 someday.
Well, that would require me to watch it, so I'm not sure about that.
That's rough. All right.
Anyway, I like this one. I thought that the fact that M'Benga could read the Vulcan emotions was really good.
Yeah. I like that someone outside of the Vulcans actually does have a sense that these Vulcans are, that there is Vulcan body language and stuff. I like that.
Yeah. All right. I'll stop ranting about different things. I think it's probably time to go.
Yeah. How long has this been recording for?
A long time.
Oh, boy. Actually, hey, not that long. We're barely over an hour.
Okay.
We're not hitting those 5-star run times.
Okay, well, see, that my worry was that I had talked about non-episode things for longer than we had talked about the episode. That was a concern of mine.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
But, you know, I would hope that a Star Trek listening audience would have some appreciation for the nonsense that I've said today.
Yeah. And I think part of it is... The episode is so finely crafted that unless we quote the speeches word for word, then we're automatically, I think, taking away a little bit from the presentation of it. You should watch this episode for sure.
It's also like evoking other stuff a lot, it felt like.
Yes.
In like small ways, though. So it's like, it's almost hard to like explain if you haven't seen the other thing, because it's like, oh, well, this looks like this specific moment.
Yeah.
And they can do that because they have such a big library to work with as far as back catalog. Like, yeah. People question sometimes, like, why do this as, like, a X... Like, why should I care about a Star Wars show for Andor, for example?
Right.
And it's because the amount of visual and audio language that you have pre-built in, like... It's not just nostalgia necessarily. It can be like, that may be why it's bankrolled, but the reason that it can be powerful is because they have such a leg up on something that needs to explain its whole universe to you.
So it's, if I could make a comparison, it's like every time a new studio takes control of Spider-Man, we have to have his introductory movie where Uncle Ben dies and stuff. And once you're able to not have to give the introduction of the superhero over and over, and you're able to go a little bit farther into the story, you can use the content that you've built up.
Yeah, well, that's part of what I liked about, like, the way that Into the Spider-Verse had first done it, is they like, just jumped, like, I know he has an origin and stuff, right. But it's different enough, and they skip a lot of the beats, and, he still has an uncle who dies. Spoilers! Spider-Man's uncle dies! So, there's stuff like that, but he, like, very much is just right into the thick of things. He's, like, able to use his powers pretty well. He does not have, like, a whole... Like, I've seen deleted scenes from the movie that I'm glad are not in it. The just, like, really generic at-home stuff. Because, like, Spider-Man can be family-oriented without having the same generic scenes. We have seen Peter Parker sit around the table with Willem Dafoe. It was a good scene.
Yeah.
But I've already seen it.
We've already seen it.
And, like, this can nod to that, you know, and jump past.
It can nod to it a little bit.
And, like, they can do quick beats that tell us, like, oh, yeah, this is happening. And they use the comic intro to each character to be like, I am the, like, kind of, like, schlubby Spider-Man who's past his prime, but I can, like, tell you a 2-minute description of my whole life. And because you already know what Peter Parker's like, then that...
You're instantly up to speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they can do that with all the different versions because they're all close enough.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the point of Spider-Verse, is they've all got enough in common.
Well, and that's the point of also Star Wars and Star Trek and a few other, like, big media properties, is when you have a few key places where you can keep on adding little bits of detail.
Yeah.
It tends to work.
I feel like Adventure Time would be a really good setting to have offshoot shows come off of, because almost anything can happen. There's tons of magic, tons of technology, both in the future and in the past. Like, the Ice King's Crown, which is from the distant past, like, way before, like, our time, is a technological, like, computer-y thing on the inside. And then, like, it harnesses magic, but, like, it itself is a piece of, like, micro-technology and stuff.
Well, so that would actually be slightly different. So in Adventure Time, a lot of stuff is kind of wacky.
It's wacky, and that's how they, like, genre
all the time.
But they introduce new stuff all the time, but, like, you kind of understand the core of the setting in a way of, like, it doesn't matter what format the people come in. There's, like, people, and there's, like, gonna be weird monsters and stuff, and people are killing each other, so there's, you know, kind of an element of, in Star Trek, you know, they have fights to the death and stuff.
They always have fights to the death. There's a lot of fights to the death. There's a lot of people that just get disintegrated, and we don't ask too many questions about it.
Wars and Trek.
You know, Star Wars doesn't disintegrate people that often.
They talk about the idea that it's worse to be disintegrated than to not, but I'm not sure I understand why.
In Star Wars?
In either of them.
In Star Trek? Yeah, I don't know.
I think being disintegrated could be painless if it was fast.
Well, and that's actually supposed to be the difference, part of the difference between phasers and disruptors, is that Federation phasers are supposed to be, theoretically, a painless disintegration when they disintegrate you, as opposed to disruptors, which are supposedly supposed to hurt as much as possible the whole time. And, like, I don't know, how much are you pulling people after they get shot with these disintegration beams? What is the scientific basis for that? I mean, I guess they scream more or something.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm totally off track. I'm all over the place right now. We can end this.
All right. Bye.
Bye.